Okay, so my talk will be very short because most people already have said most of what I wanted to say. Of course, whenever theorists make wild speculations, the good thing would be if these speculations had some agreement with the data. So there is very good data from the galactic center, so there's wonderful eccentric orbits at the very central point of 2 parsecs. Then there are this, if you enlarge this field of view by an order of magnitude, there are other sort of brighter stars, some of them, for some of the stars, we have a pretty good kinematic information as well. We don't have the full orbits, but for example, for helium emission line stars, we have the full three-dimensional velocity vectors. So this is a little bit dated. This is a picture from Genzel et al. From 2000, and these are sort of proper motion vectors of this helium-1 emission line stars, which had full 3D information about their velocities. Okay, and so Genzel et al. Have already noticed in 2000 paper that most of the stars are going clockwise on the sky, and there were two rebels, this and this, so they're going counterclockwise. And Andrei Bilobarodov and I one night had a dream that maybe the stars are in a disk. So because we had this velocity, 3D velocity vectors, we decided to look for a plane which would fit all these velocity vectors. And we found this thing. So this 12 and 13 guy, they were going counterclockwise, so we didn't even hope that they would be in the same plane. We didn't know what to do with this 11th one, but the rest 10 stars sort of were very well fit by a plane with very small chi-squared, 0.7. So this was almost immediately confirmed by Genzel's group, and they also claimed that the rebels formed another sort of subsystem. So this was the disk that we found. This was a counterclockwise disk, which seemed to be a little bit thicker. Now, the chi-squared fit for this disk was already a little bit larger because they used newer data. So this disk became somewhat thicker. And it seems that by sort of collaborating with and corresponding with Genzel's group, it seems that the thickness of these disks keeps growing with time. So the sort of the chi-square fits of this, but you know, it's sort of a tentative conclusion. They seem to be a little bit thicker, just like was mentioned already in the earlier talk. But they're significant, right? There is no doubt that this is a significant structure. So you can completely rule out any type of isotropic distribution, and you know, by chance you just get this sort of strange configuration. This you can check very rigorously with Monte Carlo simulations. Okay, so this one piece of data, and so this is the orientation of the disks. So let me just tell you a little bit how we have constrained the thickness of this disk. Basically, we have assumed that the stars came from some torus with an opening angle twice delta theta. And then you can do Monte Carlo simulations. For each run, you draw the stars which you think are in a disk. You find the best fit plane. You find chi-squared. And you compare this chi-square with chi-square which is observed in real life. And then, you plot a fraction of chi-squared, which is less than or equal to the one which is observed in real light, as a function of this opening angle of the disk. And you see that as this opening angle of the disk becomes greater than 10 degrees, and that old data, it became increasingly unlikely that, it became increasingly more less and less likely that the stars could belong to a disk with opening angle which is greater than 10 degrees. Now, I should also say that if you, and this is sort of yet unpublished work with Andrei, that if you look at if you sort of project everything on this disk and look at whether velocity vectors have any radial component relative to the black hole, what one finds is that there is some. So these orbits are certainly not circular, right? So one shouldn't think of it. Actually, some of the eccentricities are clearly quite high. Some of them are low, but some of them are significant. So we have, so now let's compare models in this context, the picture of the stars forming out of a single clean accretion disk seems kind of crazy, right? Because you have this rings which are nearly orthogonal to each other, and you have highly eccentric orbits at the center and somewhat significantly eccentric orbits of the psyllium-lined stars. It may be that if you make this scenario more complicated, it will work. For example, if you make the accretion disk warped, or if you make the two accretion episodes, then maybe you have some chance of making connection with the data. But I don't know how to simulate things like this. However, I do know how to simulate the final stages of IMBH in SPIL, so I decided to do this. Well, you've all seen this. So this is this is just the basic idea of the in spiral, and so a great idea of Brett Hansen and Milosavljevic was to put an intermediate mass black hole here at the core of this cluster, and this black hole would bind the core together and basically bring it closer to the Sagi star black hole. So this is Sagi star black hole. I won't go through all this diagram, you all know it very well. Now, from the point of view of an individual star, the story looks like this. This star is like a moon orbiting the intermediate mass black hole, and then somehow, due to external friction, this intermediate, this IMBH is brought closer to this Sagi star black hole. Then what happens is that it gets tidally stripped from this IMBH, and then its dynamics is quite complicated. It sort of experiences close encounters, typically experiences a number of close encounters with IMBH, and then finally ends up on some orbit. Okay, so we can simulate the statistics of these orbits, and then compare the statistics to what we see in the galactic center. So we have, it's a simple problem, but we wanted to do many runs like this to get a very good distribution. And in order to get a good evolution of distributions, good idea of distributions, it's good to use symplectic integrators. So normal, sort of more familiar Runge-Kutta type numerical integrators, they have this defect that they're not, your integrator doesn't faithfully represent the Hamiltonian system. So, and therefore the phase space is not conserved and sort of less sophisticated integrator. So if you want to talk about distribution, you may run into the problem that your phase space is not conserved, and you'll find some concentrations in the phase space which are not really there. Symplectic integrators are the ones which conserve phase space very well. And what they do is that instead of integrating approximately exact equations, they do exact integrations of approximate Hamiltonian, right? So you approximate your real Hamiltonian with the one which is slightly different, but the one which you can integrate exactly without any errors or with sort of machine precision. And then you do this integration. And so it conserves phase space, and it's good for evolving distributions, etc. So our algorithm, the clever bit in it was that it was designed to handle close encounters between the intermediate mass black hole and a star. And probably it can be used also for planet dynamics and sort of a broader context. Okay, so what are the results? So, What's this? That's exactly right. So the basic problem with this close encounters is that if you change your step size, like for example, if your comet or your star comes close to intermediate mass black hole, you'd really like to integrate it with small step sizes. But if you change your step size, you change your effective Hamiltonian of your integrator, and that's bad. And what you do to fight it is that you extend your phase space by two extra coordinates. And then this extended phase space has a different time. And you can design a more general Hamiltonian in such a way that you can still take equal time steps in this extended phase space, but they will map into variable time steps into your real Hamiltonian system. So if you want, I can later explain in more detail. It's actually not that complicated. Okay, so these are the results. And it seems that circular and spiral, pretty robust, gives you a picture like this. These are inclinations on the y-axis, and these are eccentricities on the x-axis. And you see that these are sort of 1,000 runs, and almost all of these runs give you inclination which is less than 10 degrees. Eccentricities can be quite significant. Some of the stars get ejected, depending on the speed of the inspiral. The number of stars which actually get ejected depends on the speed of the inspiral. However, it turns out that the orbital distribution depends crucially on the eccentricity of this IMBH. So, for example, if you consider the inspiral for the eccentric IMBH, like so, the picture is completely different, right? My 10 degrees is now at the bottom of this diagram. And actually, half of the stars, so this is eccentricity of 0.6, half of the stars end up with inclination less than 10 degrees. But half of them have inclinations which are sort of spread all over the place, and some of them flip. Some of the stars start going counterclockwise, counter to the original rotation. And the reason is that sometimes, in a large fraction of cases, there are sort of secular torques between the ellipse of the intermediate mass black hole and the ellipse of the star, which is misoriented relative to the intermediate mass black hole. And these secular torques can can drive significant evolution of angular momentum and orientation of the stellar orbit. So let me just show, just for fun, one of the stars which were sort of unfortunate enough to get flipped. This is how its inclination was evolving with time. You see, it started off small, but then it got trapped into this situation where the inclination was undergoing this large sort of secular evolution, ended up to be quite large. This is degrees on the y-axis. And the eccentricities of the stars typically reach quite high values in some regions. So this star reached the value of 0.9, the eccentricity. This is the eccentricity evolution with time, I should say. Now, I think this is interesting because if you think that you have an intermediate mass black hole at IRS13, IRS13 is still much further away than the S stars, at least on some of the S stars. And basically, there is no way by simple processes to get S stars to where they are by having, you know, if you assume that they were brought in by the black hole which is sitting at IRS13 or IRS16 for SW for that matter. They're still too far. It just never happens in simulations. The stars, they can be scattered on sort of eccentric orbits, on plunging orbits, but then they come right back out. None of them end up with semi major axis, which is significantly smaller than the location, than the radius of the intermediate mass black hole. However, if you assume that during these close passages, when the eccentricity becomes very high, there is some other process which switches on. For example, there are two ideas that I know of which can work. Andy Gould and Alice Quillen have said that if the star is a binary, then the spinary on the closed passage can get disrupted, and one element will be bound to the black hole, and the other element will get ejected. So this will work in this scenario as well. And Tal and Mario Olivier have also this idea that maybe these stars, which are on plunging orbits, will kick out sort of stellar mass black hole and then be left right next to the Sagittarius A star black hole. Now, the problems in both of these scenarios typically are how the hell do you get the stars to plunge? Well, this is sort of a natural way to get them to plunge. Okay, in conclusions, I must say that even though the inclinations here, so let me just go back a little bit, even though the inclinations, some of the inclinations here flip, they never assemble themselves into sort of a second preferred orientation, right? They don't have any preferred orientation. That's quite generic. So, therefore, there are some good ideas how to explain the data, how to explain this young stars in the galactic center. But nothing works so far. Nothing works in detail. So I don't think we should be sort of complacent and say, okay, well, it's this, and then forget about it. I don't think anything yet works. And of course, it's another point is that understanding what exactly is responsible for this is important for other supermassive black holes. So for example, if you have frequent mergers with intermediate mass black holes, that's clearly very important. This is the component of evolution of galactic nuclei which we didn't take into account before. And similarly, if you have sort of stars fragmenting from accretion disks, that can have some implications as well. Let me just stop here and take questions. Please.
Andy?
What didn't work? Yes. Yeah, but you had to have two in spirals, right? You would have to have. How do you get the second plane? One in spiral doesn't give you. Okay, I think the mess is good, right? The mess is good because at least it flips some orbit. It lifts some orbits out of the in spiral plane. Here, none of the orbits are lifted out of the in spiral plane. So unless you assume that the stars in second ring are from a separate event, then this scenario will not explain a second ring.
Brad?
It's not. It's not isotropic. You can check it rigorously. So I guarantee it's not isotropic. It may well be that if you rotate the speed, it may well be that this is an unfortunate angle of view within this plane, right? This plot may have been an unfortunate angle of view, but. Say again? No. I mean, this is the view from some location in the plane. Maybe there is a view of location. Maybe there is some other direction in the plane where you get sort of a better structure. But no, it's.
This is already projected to the plane of the.
It's projected to the plane of the sky. Yes, that's right. But so these are proper motion velocities, right? As you see. On the sky, as looking from some direction of this plane.
Not what you see. This, I think, is after you transform.
Yeah. Yes, but you can. What's done here is that you find the best fit plane, and then you think how to illustrate it. You say, okay, well, let me put myself on this best fit plane, and look at proper motions as seen from this location, okay, and then plot them on the sky. And then if the stars are in the disk, they should line up along a single line. No. So it doesn't. No. No.
Oleg.
No. No. Let's suppose that two velocity vectors are coplanar, but so this is all in the same plane, in the plane of the blackboard. But your velocity vectors are like this. Now you are living in the plane of the blackboard. You can look at it from here, in which case you'll see a very extended structure, a very extended structure in velocity space. Or you can look at it from here, in which case you'll see a very compact structure. It may be an unfortunate angle of view, but it's significantly non-isotropic. So this plot was made by Reinhard Genzel's group. But this plot was made by us, and I guess that's a good one, although it doesn't. So it doesn't look like it. You can check it, right? You can check. Well, can it look like a thin population plus a hot one? No. The answer is no.
Okay, let's move on from this issue, I think, and then Oleg got a question.
but you don't know all three components. I'm very open-minded. Maybe there is a better way of doing this. This is also quite robust, but I'm open-minded. Maybe your idea is better.
Okay, question at the back. A bit louder, please.
Yes. Yep. No, and I also for this simple plots, I also didn't take into account the precession of the orbit of the black hole and the stellar potential. I'll probably do it in the. I'm sorry, I don't understand this. Right. Why? Okay, I will.
Okay, Yoram?
No, I just put it in by hand. Analytically, there is a reason to expect that it stays almost constant, right? Use Chandrasekhar formula on any reasonable cusp, right? Well, if you have a cusp which goes r to the minus 1.5, the eccentricity stays exactly constant if you use Chandrasekhar's formula with constant Coulomb logarithm. Now, if you have in the galactic center, sort of, we have tried both minus 1.3 and also minus 1.75, and the eccentricity grows extremely slowly during this spiral, so it stays virtually constant if you believe Chandrasekhar's formula. Yeah, actually, Andy had a nice calculation in his paper with Alice for this r to the minus 1.5. But you can do it for more general cusp, and the evolution of eccentricity is very slow.
Question here?
I don't have it here, but I... yeah. Well, some of the stars, it doesn't look like anything special, really. Let me just say that some of the stars get ejected, right? They get this eccentricity higher than, but actually quite, not very many. They get ejected, they get this eccentricity higher than one. And those stars which are flipping typically have sort of their orbit of the same size, the same order of the size as the intermediate mass black hole. These ones, yeah, I mean, they can be anywhere. Anyway, so I don't have a good answer, but it doesn't look like anything special.
Sergei?
No, it's a simple three-body. It's a simple three-body simulation. I think it wouldn't, but oh yes, but it's a question of what happens to the star after it gets tidally stripped, right? And the evolution of the orbit, how the orbit evolves after it's tidally stripped, and that I think doesn't really depend on other stars.
Any further questions? Okay, well, this session will continue tomorrow with two talks and a discussion section, so bring your thoughts and ideas of, I guess, key questions and tests to answer those questions to the discussion section. Let's thank Yuri and all the speakers of the session so far.